Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are joined for the next half an hour or so with by Dr. Fawaz Jerjes, of course, professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at the London School of Economics, one of our world's leading experts on the Middle East. And Fawaz, good to have you with us once again.
Thank you for having me.
And I deeply appreciate you staying up late at night in London to talk to us.
Pleasure.
So this is since we last spoke, the volatility and political changes have just, I mean, they seem to grow exponentially day by day.
Well, obviously, there is something stirring throughout the region. And this is really not a cliche. It's real. A sense of empowerment, a sense of revival. People feel empowered. I think people are fed up with oppressive governments, dismal social and political conditions. I think people believe that if Mubarak, who was the public face of authoritarianism, a manifestation of authoritarianism, can be toppled, every single Arab and Middle Eastern dictator could also be toppled. So there is a kind of ripple effect, a great deal of social turmoil. People are fed up with really horrible conditions, as you well know, both political conditions and social and economic conditions, from Egypt to Tunisia, from Algeria to Jordan, from Bahrain to Iran. The entire region is basically up in arms.
There's so much been going on, and I want to try to get through some of these and just really hear your thoughts on a number of issues that are arising from this. Let me start with Egypt, though. There are some students saying they're going back to Tahrir Square, but and the army has been asking people not to demonstrate, workers not to strike. People are still demanding the political prisoners be released. There's a question about whether the 5-man panel from the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces will actually transition to democracy and create a new constitution, whether it's about their protecting. Part of what's going to happen is they're protecting their economic and financial interests, which are very deep in the Egyptian economy. This is a very critical moment to see what happens over the next several weeks. I'm wondering what your analysis of all that is right now in Egypt.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. I think this is a very, very critical moment, and anything that happens between now and the next 6 months will determine the post-Mubarak Egypt. That is, the mechanisms, the initiatives, the transition, the form of government. And in every experience we have, from the Philippines to Indonesia to Eastern Europe, what happens during this transitional period will determine the nature and the structure of the political and economic system. Let's see what has happened in Egypt since Mubarak left the scene. The Supreme Command Council has basically taken some major initiatives. First, it dissolved the parliament, which was, of course, rigged by Mubarak. It suspended the constitution, which was mutilated by Mubarak in the last 30 years. It pledged to hand over power to a civilian government in 6 months. These are very serious initiatives. Also, it established a committee with some of the leading jurists in Egypt to begin the process of constitutional reforms in about 2 weeks or so. So obviously, these steps are really quite very critical steps. What some of the protesters are anxious about are the following. First of all, they believe that the Supreme Command Council really is an extension of the Mubarak regime itself. The Field Marshal, Muhammad Tantawi, who is the head of the Supreme Council, is basically as old as President Mubarak. He was a very close ally of President Mubarak, very conservative, and people have questions about his willingness and desire to really transition and basically relinquish power in 6 months. The military also has refused to lift the emergency laws, which basically have been in place since 1981, since the assassination of the late President Anwar Sadat. The military also has refused to release the thousands of political prisoners. So there's a great deal of uncertainty and a great deal of fluidity. While the steps and the initiatives that have been taken by the military are really critical steps, there is much to be, remains to be done. And the protesters have not gone home, as you know, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
On Friday, the leaders of the revolution have promised a 1 million man and woman march, not only to celebrate the toppling of Mubarak, but also to really flex their muscle and show the military leaders that the revolution is real, and to also exert pressure on the military officers who are in charge now.
That's going to be amazing if that happens. I mean, that'll be the response of the Egyptian military to that march, if it's a peaceful march through Cairo.
Yes, absolutely. I don't think the military will do a thing. The military has been consistent. It has pledged not to shed Egyptian blood. It has not fired on protesters, even though there are some human rights reports which basically indicate that the army police has arrested quite a few hundred protesters since the 25th of January, since the eruption of the revolution. But I think the army officers know well that change is coming. And this is really a genuine revolution. It's not just about a few thousands or a few hundred thousands. Millions of Egyptians have basically protested over the last 3 weeks. And I suspect, even though some of the military commanders might not like to relinquish power, the reality is by dissolving the parliament and by trying to rewrite a new constitution and by pledging to relinquish power in 6 months, it tells me they're very serious. And here, I think, usually we're very critical of American foreign policy. I think the Obama administration has been playing a positive role behind the scene.
Mm-hmm.
As you well know, there's a very close relationship between the American army and the Egyptian army. The Egyptian army receives about $1.5 billion a year from the United States. And both President Obama and American military officers have been in touch with the Egyptian commanders on a daily basis. And the Obama administration has made it very clear, change must be substantive and power must be handed over to a civilian leadership. The question is not whether the military will relinquish power. The question will be, will Egypt undergo a transparent and open elections in 6 months? Will a civilian, genuine representative government be established in Egypt in 6 months? And how will the military basically guide and oversee the transition? There are many questions, but I think so far, I think the military has pleasantly surprised many of us so far in Egypt.
It's kind of reverberating throughout the Arab and large Muslim world. I mean, Bahrain, a country that has some oil reserves, but more importantly to the United States of America, has a huge military and air base with a Sunni royalty and a Shia population that are demonstrating in the streets, people being killed in those streets at the Pearl roundabout. Yemen. They are battling in the streets with pro-government supporters. Iran, reports of hundreds of thousands of people standing up to protest. Even in Libya, where people thought Muammar Gaddafi would be able to keep a lid on it, that in Benghazi and other cities, that demonstrations were unfolding and challenging police. I mean, every day something new is happening.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, I think this goes beyond Tunisia and Egypt. I think even though Bahrain is not Iran, and Yemen is not Algeria, and Jordan is not Tunisia, I mean, every country has its own structure and its own system. So social and political system. I think the similarities are much more critical than the differences. And I think for your listeners, to my mind, if I may summarize what all these countries share, first, they share what I call oppressive governments, authoritarian governments, closed political systems. That is, and this, it's not just as simple as that. They lack legitimacy. That is, they have a vacuum of legitimate political authority. Their citizens perceive them as illegitimate. And the gap of legitimacy has been widening by the year, point one. Point two, not only you have authoritarianism, you have failed economic systems. Every government, including Iran, including Egypt, Tunisia, and Algeria, they have failed to deliver the goods, unlike Singapore and some of the authoritarian governments in other parts. While they were authoritarian, but they were able to deliver the goods. In the Arab world and the Middle East, political oppressiveness coincided with, failed economies. And thirdly, and this is a very important point, the overwhelming majority of the population in the Middle East are basically is young population. That is, you have between 60 and 70% of the 400 million Middle Easterners who are below the ages of 30 years old. Huge, huge constituencies. Coupled with that, you have what I call free flow of information, globalization, internet, Twitter. You have Al Jazeera. The Al Jazeera effect has been devastating. So not only you have closed political system, dismal economic and social conditions, and also the inability of the governments to control the flow of information. All these elements, all these factors converged and produced what I call the, turmoil and upheaval in the region. So the crisis is not really recent. The crisis has been with us for the last 20, 30 years. It's just now the convergence of many factors. And, of course, Tunisia provided the spark that has ignited the political fires in almost every single Middle Eastern country.
Well, we don't know where any of this will end up. I mean, this is clearly it's still kind of growing and germinating. But if you look at places, let's just say a couple of the countries, Bahrain and Yemen, both on the Arabian Peninsula. Bahrain, just separated by Saudi Arabia, literally a highway connects them, and it's the Saudis are really protect Bahrain, and if an army goes in to put it down, it'll be the Saudi army, and Yemen on the southwestern coast of Saudi Arabia. I mean, these two things right there, along with Iraq and other places, I mean, there has to be a real threat to the Saudi monarchy as well.
Well, I mean, I think regardless of whether, some of them survive or not, what we are witnessing really is the end of an era. I mean, I like to think of it, and I might be probably over-exaggerating. It's really the end of the dictatorship age, not just in the Middle East. I think you have now a new sensibility, universal sensibility, and it has swept the world. It is the Arab world, the Middle East, the democratic wave, has finally reached the shores and the deserts of the Middle East, even though it's two decades later on. So in this particular sense, even if some of them, some of the dictators survive, I think what you have, the Middle East will never be the same. You have an empowered population. You have rising social classes that demand not just bread and butter, but freedom and personal, individual freedom and liberty. The beauty about really what we're witnessing in the Middle East, I mean, to me as a student of world politics, this is, as you know, Mark, it's not about American colonialism or Western imperialism or Israeli foreign policy. You don't hear such slogans.
Mm-hmm.
You hear slogans about freedom, open societies, transparent elections, representation, jobs, employment. And this represents a qualitative shift. So even if some of them survive, I think what we're going to witness is a new kind of politics, new language of politics. It's really the end of an era and the beginning of a new one. And I think yesterday President Obama was very explicit, very blunt. He said it, and he said to friend and foe, we tell you that things have changed. You must come to terms with the new realities, the universal quest for human rights. And he addressed America's allies, and he said, you have to change. It's not even a choice now. If you want to survive, you have to change. Bahrain is a case in point. I mean, Bahrain has always been one of the most volatile states in the Gulf. Bahrain has a majority of Shiite population, 70%, yet it's governed by a tiny minority Sunni population. And the Shiite population for the last, 20 years has been complaining about discrimination in jobs, in government jobs, talks about arrests and torture and human rights violations and the fact they are treated as like second-class citizens. So Bahrain is an example now. Bahrainis have finally taken a page out of the Tunisian and Egyptian chapter. Yemen is an entirely different case. Yemen might plunge into civil wars because of the tribal nature of society. Plus, you have a separatist movement in the south. You have an insurgency in the north. You have a small, little, tiny al-Qaeda faction in central Yemen. But even Iran is no longer safe. I mean, Iran has been boiling since the last elections. And many Iranians now realize that if the Egyptians can topple one of the most entrenched authoritarian systems, they can also do so. So it's this kind of, really, you cannot understand what's happening except by understanding the psychology and also the changing attitudes throughout the region, that people believe that they are now in charge. And I think if there is, to quote Thomas Jefferson, I think what has changed in the Middle East is the traditional equation that people are terrified of the government has been turned on its head. Now governments are terrified of their people. And this changes the whole dynamics of Middle Eastern politics. It's really a new game. It's a new language. It's a new day.
It's irrevocable, I think, in many ways. And I've actually paid attention to my listeners at 410-319-8888. We have Dr. Fawaz Georges here just for a few more minutes. So please come join us at 410-319-8888. Because what we're seeing here, I think it is like, I've been talking to a lot of people on the ground throughout the Arab world in the last couple of weeks from many places. And I think a couple of things are going on, and I'd like to see your thoughts on it. A, I think in terms of the world outside the Arab world, it is beginning to change the American and international Western perception of the Arab world in terms of the Arab people, beginning to change all of the kind of – slowly beginning to will kind of force people to revisit the stereotypical views we have of Arab people, A. And B, that this to me in some ways – is akin in terms of the earth-shaking possibilities of this, what it may portend for the future, as the American Revolution of 1776.
You know, Mark, I mean, really, as you well know, after 9/11, so much nonsense has been basically said about that part of the world. Think about it, Mark. I mean, the neoconservative ideologically basically infected rhetoric about the violent Arab, about the violent Islam, about the fact that Muslims and Islam are incompatible with democracy, about the exceptionalism, so much hatred. I mean, in particular, I mean, as an American myself, it's very painful to see this kind of, rhetoric reaching the United States, in particular over the debates, the Islamic Center in New York. I think, really, if there is one lesson we have all learned about, is the dignity of the Egyptian people, the dignity of the Arab people, young Arabs. I mean, if Americans, if our people realize, our citizens, fellow citizens realize that if you have 40 million Egyptians who live on less than $2 a day, you have abject poverty and decadent wealth, oppression. You would have expected a bloodbath, massacres. Think of how peaceful the revolution has been. Mm-hmm. Think of how, dignified the Egyptian people. Those people are literally, millions are starving. They wait for hours just to get 6 loaves of bread. And those people are not basically blaming the world. They're not blaming America for their predicament. So I think on multiple levels, I hope myself, as a student of the region, really, and as an American, that a new narrative will basically emerge out of this turmoil, that people are worldwide are the same. They have the same aspirations of dignity, of decency. They want to have a better life. They want to be free. This is a universal that Arabs don't really differ from Americans. And I do hope that the United States really, we get the right lessons that we should not basically support dictators, because dictators are not a bastion of stability. They're not really a guarantee for stability. That we must take risks. There are risks, Mark. I mean, we know this. All revolutions, have tremendous risk. But the reality is, I think, the risks are worth it, because once, open societies are established, once the rising social classes are given a say in the political process, once relations become equal between that part of the world and the West, I think you're going to have a less angrier crowd. You're going to have a more decent and more peaceful and more prosperous Middle East, I hope.
Dr. Faraz Joges, once again, thank you so much for taking this time so late at night for you in London to join us.
It's always a pleasure.
Take care of yourself, and thank you so much again. Our guest has been Faraz Joges, Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics, and we will keep our eye on the Middle East every day we can during the course of our program, because it's changing the nature of our planet, and we're bringing you the best minds we can around the world to join us for these conversations. On our way to break here, I will remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can just go to the Steiner Show website and click on their banner. We'll be right back.